Autosport.com. All the news first.
Hello and welcome to the first Autosport podcast of 2012. Now, your regular host, Henry Hope Frost, is off enjoying the parks and playgrounds of Surrey. He's got a bit of a holiday. So they've asked me, Alan Hyde, to take over the mic, which is jolly nice of them. Thank you very much indeed. Joining me in the pod, our Autosport editor-in-chief, Andrew van der Burt.
Hello.
F1 editor, Ed Straw.
Hello.
And news editor Glenn Freeman.
Hi, Alan.
And all the way from Manchester via telephone, we'll be enjoying the Grand Prix editor, Mark Hughes. So before we end up with a Marussia spec delay, let's crack on with part one.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
So, Ed, we've seen the vast majority of the 2012 Formula One cars now, and quite frankly, they're not the best-looking bunch in the world, are they? I think we knew it, didn't we? But why is it?
Well, before I answer that, I have to say, having you here rather than Henry, I've got this nagging feeling about leaving bags unattended that I need to do something about. But
please do anyway. Not leave them.
I haven't, I promise.
Good.
Well, it's the slope in the nose, isn't it? Everyone can see that. It's a function of the rules and geometry. There's nothing trick about it. In order to get the nose lower for safety reasons in side impacts, rear impacts, etc., the front section of the car, the nose, if you like, is 75 millimetres lower than it was last year. The chassis, if you like, where the monocoque ends, the height restriction is the same as it was last year. So everybody wants, or the most of them, want to get the chassis as high as possible to get the most airflow under the car to generate some downforce. The only team that, in general, hasn't followed that trend of late has been McLaren, which is why they've got the more aesthetically pleasing nose, shall we say. So they've basically kept with the same concept they had last year rather than changed. The other thing you see is the Ferrari, the Sauber, for example, have got the nose just at the absolute maximum height. So they've got this vast shelf at the front of the car. And that's for the same reason, to make sure that you get the maximum benefit out of it, because that shelf is going to create some turbulence and some aerodynamic problems.
Can I say a couple of things just about launches of Formula One cars? Are we coming into a season maybe now where we're going to have slightly more sensible Formula One car launches? McLaren's one was online. It was perfectly presented online. It was beautiful. It was no frills, was it?
I miss the overblown, pointless
pomp
and ceremony, you know, having the car suspended above, you know, the Parthenon or whatever it was. It was great. And also, from an editorial point of view, they never used to clash. You used to have one a week, starting about the second week of January, running on to the end of February. And it was manna for a magazine maker, because you'd have a different one on the cover every week.
Ed.
Well, we had a load of launches at the Jerez Test last week, and I can say we didn't have a single Spice Girl there. Nowadays, you actually get more Spice Girls at the BTCC on your page.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I think that does it for now. Let's go over and join Mark Hughes. Mark, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah, looking forward to the new season.
Now, you were supposed to be at the launch of the new Ferrari before it was snowed off. The opening couple of days in Jerez didn't go too well for the team, and there was a very honest assessment of the team's plight from Pat Fry. Have they already dropped the ball this year?
I think I'd be cautious about reading too much into it at this stage, but they definitely didn't have the start they were expecting, which the alarm bells that should be ringing is that correlation, is there correlation between the tools at the factory and the track correct? Because that was one of the big problems they had last year. They'd made big changes in the wind tunnel and hadn't realised that it completely skewed the correlation. And so they were working all through last season trying to correct that, because it's a major job, because they'd increased the size of the models. And that was causing the data to be corrupted through its interference with the walls of the tunnel. And that was an ongoing thing all through last year. And so if they weren't getting what they were expecting when they put the car on the track for the first time this year, that they would be the alarm bells that are ringing. That's not necessarily what the problem is, but that I'm sure that's the first thing that they'll be looking to establish, that it's not a correlation problem, that it's actually just something that can be worked through on the car.
I suppose the one thing that we did get as a result of the launch being snowed off, we did get some very pretty pictures, and not the kind of pictures that you normally expect a Formula One car to be in the environment of snowy backgrounds.
Yeah, it's more like the Swedish rally, wasn't it?
It was a little bit, yeah. It certainly was. Now, we know it's very dangerous to read too much into testing, but what did we learn from Jerez?
I think we can quite safely say that the Red Bull and McLaren are there or thereabouts. We don't know exactly how they compare in anybody compares in terms of their fuel weight. So each team will have their own sort of program to work through, where they will have relatively high fuel and relatively low fuel. But quite often, a team will always have, for example, 30 kilos of fuel minimum in it, so that the picture is muddied. Other teams might have 40 kilos in minimum, others 20. So you can't compare definitively team with team, but when you analyze the lap-by-lap runs, you can see the pattern of performance, and it looks pretty good for both Red Bull and McLaren. Lotus is the interesting one, because if we just take it at face value, they are right on the pace, but on a one-lap basis, but on a run, they don't look quite as close. But I think they're set for probably a better season than the one they've just had.
Maybe we can bring Andy in on this.
Yeah, Mark, I was just looking back at last year's pre-season testing. The Lotus, or Renault as they were called then, looked pretty good then. Are they sort of testing specialists now?
It's not so much in, I think, in their case of trying to look good. I think it's more that's what they base their runs around, what their fuel weight is, you know, their minimum, what I was talking about before, the minimum fuel that they'll always have in. And I think you'd think that when they, Kimi and Grosjean did those particularly quick times, you'd suspect they had less fuel in than the Red Bull and the McLaren. But on the long runs, it looks more realistic. And it looked to be maybe something like 8/10 off on a long run. But that's better than a lot of teams look at the moment.
I remember this years ago, though, in testing. The Jordans were always the quickest cars. They all did an incredible job in testing. And then come the start of the season, my excitement dwindled away rather quickly. Now, though, we've heard that the car's running in Jerez with less front wing than was the norm in recent seasons. Why is this? And what type of driver is possibly likely to benefit?
I think the reason is because they've got less rear downforce as well, because the blown exhausts have gone. So there's less rear downforce, so you need less front downforce to balance the car. The problem isn't generating front downforce with this set of rules. The problem is generating enough rear downforce. So the front's just there to balance, really, what they can get from the rear. And the more they can get from the rear as the season goes on, you'll see the front wings increasing in size as well. In terms of the types of driver, it's not a sort of night and day. I don't think it's a definitive type of driver. I think the key is going to be, as ever, getting a well-balanced car, something that that can be lent on with confidence, and that doesn't give the driver any nasty surprises. The lack of blown exhaust performance from the rear, there may be drivers who'd got their head around the specific techniques required for that, that may have had that advantage nullified a little bit, but I don't know. We'd need to see it play out in a lot more detail than we can see in testing.
Glenn Freeman's here in the studio. Glenn, a couple of thoughts on this?
Well, just talking about how drivers have got to adapt, one of the new, well, technically new drivers we've got is Romain Grosjean, the GP2 champion. I dealt with him last year and saw him sort of really grow up on and off the track. How's he settling in, do you think, now he's finally got a full-time drive at Lotus?
Well, it looks pretty good, doesn't it? You talk about how he grew up, and certainly I noticed the big contrast between the haunted driver we had in Formula 1 2009 and the guy that's been around the paddock this year. He just seems to be so much lighter and easier, at ease with himself. But I think that time away, he's really sort of asked himself some questions and come up with some answers. I think he's doing very well. He looks pretty good.
Hey, Mark, it's great that you joined us all the way from Manchester. What's the weather doing up there at the moment?
Dry but cold.
Snow-free. Always good to hear. Great stuff. Thanks, Mark. That's all for part one in the Autosport podcast. Coming up later, the pod wonders whether Kimi Raikkonen still has it, what's going on at HRT, really, and whether WRC has a future.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Welcome back to the second part of the Autosport podcast for 2012. What's next on the agenda? Kimi Raikkonen. Andrew, he seems to be on the cover of every single magazine, in particular Autosport magazine this week. Is he really that popular?
Staggeringly, yes. For a guy that has probably only given half a good interview once, and that was when he swore on TV talking to Martin Brundle ahead of Schumacher's retirement, he has an amazingly passionate following. And I think that's part of the allure. I mean, this is a guy who dresses up in a monkey suit and enters his name as James Hunt in these snowmobile events, and the fans love it. And the fact that he's a world champion and he's come back to a team in its black and gold livery, and he goes out the first day of testing and he's quickest. It's just a story that keeps on giving at the moment, and I hope he can see it through.
Maybe we'll get a quick comment from Ed.
Yeah, well, I watched him trackside in the Jerez test last week, and yeah, he can still drive a Formula One car. He was straight away able to lean on it, get the car working. That probably shouldn't really be a surprise. This is a guy who could excel in a Sauber when he was just out of racing in Formula Renault. I think there are sterner tests to come from Kimi in terms of how he gets on when things maybe get a bit harder, maybe if the car's not quite where he'd hope it will be. But in terms of the pure driving, he's there and he's committed. I remember at one stage I was watching on the first day, standing basically by the pit lane entrance, and you saw him coming in, massively committed, took a big bite of the grass, you know, doing a proper in-lap, and you thought, yeah, this is a guy who's not here to hang around. He's trying to get everything he can out of the limited testing.
He did have quite a few options as well this year, didn't he? There were a couple of things that he was weighing up.
Yeah, I mean, he went quite a long way down the line with Williams. I think it'd be interesting to hear his off-the-record response to if you asked him what happened there. I hear it was quite fruity in the end. But I think it's what Lotus needed. You know, the loss of Robert Kubica was a huge blow to that team. And let's not forget, they were a title-winning team not that long ago. And, you know, they're a team worthy of having a former world champion on there. And I think, you know, the lineup of Raikkonen and Grosjean is a really exciting one for them. And I hope it works.
Glenn, a couple of thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it has been a great story so far, the Kimi thing, really, ever since he left Formula One and went to rallying. As Andy says, it keeps on giving. But now we've seen him in his first test in his new car. I'm a little bit bored of him. It was great he was quickest on the first day. But we're not going to get any answers now until we get to Australia. And I remember a couple of years ago going to the final test pre-season at Barcelona and watching Michael Schumacher ahead of his comeback. And he did a stint where he was wheel-to-wheel with Lewis Hamilton, lap after lap. And I thought, I can't wait to see this. Yeah. And then for the past 2 years, Lewis, for the most part, has been at the front and Michael's been three or four rows back. So we've been let down once before by a comeback. I hope we're not let down again.
Ed?
Going back to the Williams talks he held, I think you have to take that as a bit of a positive. The fact that he was willing to seriously consider joining a team that scored 5 points last year and was not a particularly happy place to be at least suggests that in his own mind at the moment, he actually wants to be an F1. He's not just doing it because he feels vaguely like he wants to do it or he wants a bit of money. So that gives me some encouragement that he's going to give it his best.
We always talk about the fact that Kimi doesn't give incredibly extensive interviews and isn't particularly forthcoming with the media. I mean, you know him of old. You've had to deal with him. I remember him back in days of Formula Renault. Never really had a problem chatting to him all the way back then. Is this a character that he's made and the media kind of bigs it up as well?
I think there's an awful lot of myths surrounding Kimi. He's not a great soundbite machine. He will only go into detail and answering questions if he is really interested in it and fancies it. In fact, recently, some of the questions that he's given the most in-depth and interesting answers to have been about rallying and analysing what he was doing there. Whereas the F1 questions, I think it's a bit, he thinks, oh, this is the same old stuff, so I'll just sort of say a few things.
It has to interest him, doesn't it? He needs to be interested in what he's talking about.
Well, he said it himself, things like testing, once it goes beyond a certain point, he's just not interested in. He just wants to jump into the car, race it, drive it as quick as he can and get some wins. And that's perhaps his appeal to people. He's this old-fashioned racing driver, isn't he? He just wants to drive the car. Perhaps that doesn't always help him. And in the past, there have been times where that trait hasn't been perfect for him, but I think that's why people love him.
I, for one, am a fan, and I can't wait for 2012 to see how Kimi gets on at Lotus. Tyres, we always have to talk about tyres, and Pirelli, of course, are changing the tyres again this year, changing them quite dramatically. It was a dramatic change last year, another change this year, Ed. What impact is this likely to have from Australia?
I think the priority is that they're trying to ensure that the tyres remain interesting. It's a change, but I think that's largely because the teams were more and more getting on top of the tyres as the season went on, because they've got, you know, massive teams. They have a huge amount of data. Whatever you give them, they will master it very quickly, and the strategies will converge. Paul Hembree said in an interview I did with him for Autosport that the aim is to replicate or go beyond what they did last year. So I think as long as they get two stop races, sometimes three stop races, and we don't go back to 2010 Bridgestones where you had one pit stop and they only made that because they had to, I think they'll probably be on to a winner.
Glenn?
I'm sceptical, purely because Pedro De La Rosa was talking to our guys in Spain last week, and obviously he's done some testing for Pirelli last year. He knows them well. He's an excellent test driver. That's why he had such a long career with McLaren, even when he wasn't racing. And he says that the changes they've made to the tyres, well, firstly, they've made them nicer to drive on, so the drivers will be more comfortable, which surely reduces the opportunity for mistakes, which generate overtaking. And while they've moved the compounds closer together, we're not going to have what we had at the start of last year with cars and drivers falling off the cliff, was the term. And that was when races were thrown wide open. And he says, even if they've made the harder compounds softer, the teams understand how these work now. And all it will give us is maybe an extra pit stop per race. I don't think it's going to give us some of those races we had in the first half of last year, where there were spells, particularly towards the end, where the race was wide open. You saw some fantastic racing. From what Pedro was saying and from what we've seen so far and from what we've heard from Pirelli, I'm not expecting it to go back to what we had at the start of last year.
It's a very valid point. I think the races we saw early last year were exceptions. The only way you could consistently recreate that is by changing the tyres constantly. I mean, these tyres that they're having this year, they're from the same family of tyres, if you like. It's using the same ideas. You know, the construction has changed a little bit, the compounds have changed, so it's changed, but you're not going to get that sort of grasping around in the dark feel from the teams where they're getting caught out by things again.
No, and I have to say that's not a criticism of Pirelli, because Formula One teams employ hundreds of people to work this stuff out, so they were always going to get to the bottom of it, and that really isn't Pirelli's fault. That's just the way Formula One works, and that's why rule changes in Formula One always give us a bit of excitement, because suddenly there's some new elements that the teams have to understand. And then when everybody's maximising those elements, you know, the cars are in the correct order and they stay there. Mm.
Let's talk about Lotus. I'm quite happy that 12 months down the line, we are sure which car is going to be called the Lotus. And it's got a lovely livery and looks very impressive. And after testing, it's a half-decent car, isn't it?
The team are very happy with it. Watching on track, the thing you can definitely say is it's a very usable, drivable car. The drivers can be consistent with it. They can attack. They can work the rear a little bit without getting caught out, which is a positive. How ultimately quick it is, we're going to have to wait for a bit to see. We'll start to see that in the two Barcelona tests that are coming up. But, you know, the Lotus is a good car. You know, the Red Bulls were still setting the standard. The grip it had at the rear when the throttle was being applied was just fantastically good, and they look like they've got a good base package. I mean, as Mark said earlier, McLaren look thereabouts. There's not many teams you look at and you think, oh, what's going on here? Obviously Ferrari, they need a little bit more time. The Williams didn't look brilliant. They looked kind of like, handling wise, they were towards the back of that group. But let's go to Barcelona, which is probably the best test track out there. It's the best indicator of how a car is aerodynamically. That'll tell us a hell of a lot more.
Okay, now there was no sign of Marussia at the test. What's going on there, Ed? What do you know?
Well, the new Marussia will be out, a Virgin as was, will be out at the third test, which begins on March the 1st at Barcelona. They should have the old car at the next test, partly to give Charles Pic, their new French driver, a little bit of mileage, and partly to understand the tyres. I mean, obviously they're late with the car, which isn't particularly good news. They've had a complete technical change, new facility. Pat Simmons is the de facto technical director. We can't call him technical director for various boring.
He won't be at the Grand Prix, will he? He won't actually be there, will he?
Yeah, he's a consultant in the team. Yes. A full-time consultant, but he's a consultant. So, I mean, that's really, really putting them up against it. I mean, the last 2 years, they've been last in the championship behind HRT on both occasions in terms of the best result count back that they use. It's not a great start. I mean, I think Marussia have to look at this season as a starting again year. Mm. And in your third year, that's pretty worrying because it takes a long time, as Caterham / Lotus as was have shown. It takes a long time to cruise up on that mid-pack, and I think this is going to be another long, hard year for that team, which is a shame because there's a tidy little race team there under John Booth that could do a good job.
Mm. Well, they've also got what I believe is a cracking little driver lineup as well. I mean, you think what Timo Glock's reputation, how that grew during his time at Toyota, and he's almost anonymous now because of the machinery he's been in. And I think in Charles Peak, they've got someone with a lot of potential and a lot of speed. I mean, he had the highest average qualifying position in GP2 last year. He's not come in as a renter driver. He's a proper talent who deserves a chance. And you just hope that two drivers of that calibre can get a car where they can actually show what they can do.
Hmm. Let's move on to HRT. Narain Karthikeyan is back at HRT. Andy, why?
Oh, because he's living a dream. He's finally back in India to enable him to do hopefully the full season. Obviously, the last time he did that, he only got halfway. But I think this time he's got the assurances he's going to be there for the full year, and he's going to give it a go. And I hope that he gets a bit fairer crack at the whip this time. Obviously, this time last year when HRT were in a bit of trouble, he hadn't even driven the car before they got to Australia and had to sit in the pits watching them practice and qualify, and you know they weren't allowed to start the race, and it's not been a particularly encouraging start with them having failed two parts of the crash test, so they're already on the back foot there. But I like Narain, and I think he's actually a much better driver than people give him credit for. And what you'd want to see is him in a half-decent car in a wet race, and I think he could surprise a lot of people.
And of course, he's been around plying his trade for many, many years, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, you know, you would have seen him in British F3 or World Series or in A1. You know, the guy's a great racer. When his heart's in it, when he's in the mood, he can be as quick as anyone. Mm. He just, you know, he's never going to win a race in an HRT, but I think, you know, I just like the circumstances to conspire for him to actually show what he could do. I think it would surprise people.
There is a thing, isn't there, just being on the grid of a Formula One Grand Prix. That's a massive thing. You can give up, we have proof already this season, you can give up a very good test job and presumably a very good job, but to be on the grid is something very special.
Well, there are only 24 F1 drivers in the world, and that's a very, very select group, isn't it? Mm,
certainly is. Now, this week we've had calls from various British politicians for the Bahrain race to carry on or to be cancelled, and against the backdrop of the civil unrest which continues there. Ed, do you think we might be looking at a 19 race calendar this season or not?
It's looking like it could go that way. It's very, very hard to second guess what's going to happen there. Obviously, on February the 14th, the anniversary of their world title Day of Rage, it kicked off a little bit there. I mean, there've been calls from politicians on both sides. We had one group saying that it should not go there because it endorses the regime. We've had another group saying that, well, it can be a force for good and for reform. And in principle, both those arguments can hold water. However, what is unquestionably the situation is that there are a number of teams concerned about safety implications. Currently, at the time of recording this, there's no Foreign Office warning or anything, so that's okay at the moment. The other question is sponsors, whether they want to be associated with what is a state-funded advert race, effectively. This isn't a race in Bahrain, this is Bahrain's race. And there is a difference there that, for me, negates the politics and sport don't mix argument, which is pretty naive at the best of times. On balance, I would say that there's a good chance it won't go ahead, but I think there's going to be a little bit more water under the bridge before that happens, and certainly it's going to be some time before we get a definitive answer. The one thing I'm happy with is that it follows straight on from China and my flight's come back through the Middle East, so my travel's sorted, whatever.
It might be okay. What's it like being at the Bahrain Grand Prix?
It's fine. You know, it's a slightly characterless Middle East country. It's not a place I'd necessarily jump to go on holiday, not because there's anything particularly wrong with it. It's fine. I mean, obviously, the interesting thing will be things have changed a lot since Formula One was last there in 2010. And I think whatever happens, that this race is totemic, isn't it? It will be used by both sides, be it for propaganda, and it will be used to point out human rights violations, etc. So it's almost untenable, this race, is probably the way I'd look at it. It's a shame that it cropped up so early in the calendar, and I think this was always going to happen. And it's going to be a talking point, and then it'll perhaps even money that it will be cancelled and it'll be put on the calendar next year, and then we do the same thing 12 months down the line, which is not ideal.
And so endeth part two of the Autosport podcast, the first one of 2012. Coming up in part three, Peugeot quits sports cars, Eurosport ditches the World Rally Championship, and V8 Supercars finally bags a third manufacturer.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Welcome back to part three of the Autosport podcast. Glenn, let's kick off with you and let's talk rallying. A few weeks ago, the WRC was brought back from the brink as Eurosport stepped in to fill the promoter void. The next thing, the deal's off and everything's back in the balance again. Glenn, what's going on, WRC?
Well, it's still on the brink and it's going to be there for a little while, I think. We've now got a bit more of a timescale because since the Eurosport deal collapsed, and it's probably worth noting that it was the FIA that pulled out of the talks, not Eurosport. They've now put it out to tender. They've said to everybody, right, if you think you can promote this, come to us. This is the FIA. And they've set a deadline of the end of March to say we'll have a decision by then. So it's going to be in limbo for a little while. But at least it's in limbo because they've decided it's going to be for that period. Because at Monte Carlo in January, FIA President Jean Todt said, we'll have a resolution by Sweden. He said, as good as that. And then it all fell apart. So at least this time, there's a bit more long-term thinking as far as sorting the deal. They're not working week to week now. They're saying, right, this is our deadline, end of March. Let's try and get it fixed by then. And they're really looking at this, all the people that running the championship from the FIA side, now looking at this. This is a clean slate for the World Rally Championship. All of the previous contracts that existed, be it with TV companies, with the events themselves, with everybody, they're all essentially void now because the promoter the contracts were held with don't exist. So I think the optimism comes from the fact that there's people in the FIA, in particular the president, Jean Todt, you know, his career and his relationship with rallying goes back a long way. And he wants to make the World Rally Championship great again. And I think he senses now there's an opportunity for him to come in. He's met a lot of resistance to his ideas so far. Mm. Now I think he senses there's a chance to start again. And providing they can get that promoter by the deadline they've set, then they can really start trying to turn this into, you know, turn it into the great product it should be.
So this is potentially an optimistic time rather than a pessimistic time. You know, I thought it was all doom and gloom, but with Jean Todt behind the negotiations, and as you quite rightly say, he is a force to be reckoned with as far as rallying is concerned. He's got it in his blood, essentially.
Yeah, you know, he will be the last man to want to pull the plug on that championship. So it's good for the championship that he's there and he's at the helm. He'll do all he can. But I think they have to be optimistic now, because if you remain pessimistic for this period of time, I don't think anybody would be still coming to work for their teams or events or anything.
So. What does it do for the teams? Well, you know, how does it affect them?
Well, they just want a resolution. They want a resolution. They're going to keep turning up to the rallies, but it makes it very hard for them looking at sponsors and logistics and stuff like that, because the plug could be pulled at any point, whether people like it or not. So it's more for them at the moment. They're almost on the outside looking in. They're being consulted, and they just want to have a sport to compete in, because people get involved in these sports because of passion for the most part. It's a very small percentage that do it for other reasons. So everybody's crossing their fingers, and they know that there's no point getting downbeat about it. You've got to try and be part of the solution and not the problem.
Andy, let's bring you in.
While it's not as simplistic as to say that the ProDrive Mini relationship ended as a result of there not being a promoter behind the WRC, the fact that they were unable to find a lead sponsor for that programme when it had shown stage-winning pace, podium-winning potential, Sordo produced a great drive in Monte Carlo, I think is indicative of the state WRC finds itself in terms of its global promotion, how visible it is to people. You know, this is a once great sport. I was taken to see a new Group B film that's coming out, and you look at those cars, you know, and they were literally covered in big name sponsors. They had helicopter support everywhere. Money was being thrown at it. It's sort of Formula One levels. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, and when a manufacturer like Mini and a team like ProDrive can't secure a head sponsorship deal, I think, you know, there are some very, very big questions around the whole of that. Luckily, we've got VW waiting in the wings, which might sort of change the balance a little bit.
That's a really good point, because if anybody can find a big name sponsor, it's going to be ProDrive and the history that they've got of attracting big name sponsors.
Exactly.
Mm. Glenn.
Well, we talk about how great rallying once was. The last WRC event I went to was Rally Sweden 2 years ago. And I went just as a punter on a general admission and followed it, chased it through the forests and stuff like that. And when you're up close, when you're sat on a rock at Sebastian Loeb's turning point, and you see what they're doing, even in the cars that don't look as spectacular from a distance now, that sport is phenomenal still.
Isn't it?
But I just think something they've somehow got to convey it, because in the past, the Group B cars looked outrageous. Mm. So instantly in a picture or in a 5-second TV clip, you were blown away.
Yep.
The bones are all still there. They just need to start putting the meat back on them and really do the sport justice, because in the flesh, it's still great, but I just don't think it comes across at the moment to the outside world. And that's where how you get the sponsors and the interest.
Has Ed Moby got the answer to this?
I think I've just got more questions. But no, the point about being able to transmit that, the appeal of the sport, you know, it's been a long time since I've been to a WRC event, but you stand stage side and you watch it, and it is amazing.
It is.
Also, it's a similar thing with Formula One. I get to stand track side and watch the cars, and it really is amazing. And you watch on the TV, and it doesn't quite come through to you. I think, in a way, there's been a lot of emphasis in rallying in terms of the format, what's best for live TV, this, that, and the other. But I think the bottom line of it is you need people to sit down, watch the television, and go, wow, there is no way I could do that. And I think that's perhaps something that's been lost, and perhaps that's the kind of key to making it a popular television sport.
I'm not sure that you particularly get the idea of speed watching Formula One on the television, but you're quite right, Glenn. You cannot replicate that feeling that you get standing trackside at a WRC round on the television.
Well, you say that, but I always think
the onboards
are just superb. You know, when they're going through a gate that's like 6 inches either side of the car or whatever, and I always think they miss a trick with that. They like to show these big helicopter shots or whatever, but it doesn't convey the speed. Just put me on board with the cars, like Loeb's thrashing it through a corner in fifth gear, you know, inches from a bank on one side. You know, I'm sold.
Ultimately, you want to make the rally viewer feel like he's one of those idiots who's standing in the middle of the stage to take a photo and then just dives out of the way at the last minute.
Yes,
just avoids getting run over by Juha Kankkonen or something like that.
Maybe 3D television has got its place in this, who knows. Another bolt from the blue was Peugeot's decision to end its sports car programme with immediate effect. Now, what's this going to mean for the World Endurance Championship, Andy, first of all?
Well, sports car racing and world rallying are sort of... have a strange parallels in them, and you know, especially with sports cars, it's always boom and bust. And just as we looked as though we were going into one of those glorious boom phases with Audi, Peugeot, and Toyota just on the horizon coming in, the Peugeot announcement comes. But on the backdrop of not selling cars, you know, they're in big financial trouble, and the undeniable bottom line is that the program was there to win the 24-hour Le Mans, and in 5 attempts they won it once. You know, this is it was a perfect storm of things working against them. Now, the unfortunate thing for the World Rally Championship is the World Endurance Championship, they were a very key player in establishing that calendar. So there are races in places like Brazil, which was a key market for Peugeot, that doesn't really do anything for Audi and Toyota, that they're now saddled with for at least a season. And so I think it does put a bit of pressure on that championship. Audi's now effectively the only real manufacturer involved, and it's going to really struggle to keep that world status that it needs.
On the subject of Peugeot and their Le Mans record, you know, their record against Audi everywhere else is phenomenal. They've almost always produced a quicker car and got results elsewhere. They've won other championships, but nobody notices. And if you do sports cars as a manufacturer, you are there to win Le Mans, because that's the race that the world knows about. As for the subject of what it means for the championship, they've averted the crisis by getting Toyota to expand their program this year. Because for it to be a world championship, as well as going to all these markets, one of the stipulations is understood to be that it needs two manufacturers in the top class. Mm. And Toyota didn't want to do much this year. A couple of races, maybe a couple of the Asian races at the end. It looks like they're going to expand that program, so it's still going to be good, and it's going to have two manufacturers, and let's not forget Porsche still coming in. But it's one of those things where it's okay, but it was on the verge of greatness, and we're gonna have to wait a little bit longer for that. So I think that's the biggest disappointment, really.
Ed,
it's a good illustration, the Peugeot situation, of the vicious circle of manufacturer racing. Obviously it's hard financial times. You know, any company that's having to tighten its belt doesn't want to be wasting money on racing. But obviously continuing this programme wouldn't have been vastly expensive. The car's there, little bit of development work and an operating budget for it, if you like. And I'm sure if they sat down and looked at that in isolation, they'd have thought, yeah, we can keep doing this. But it's the problem is, even if the budget's potentially there, you can't be seen to be doing this kind of thing. So as soon as you get into these times, you're down both ways, really. If you can afford it, you don't want to be seen to be affording it. And so it just creates some instability. When you've got something like sports car racing, which does thrive on having manufacturers in there, that means that this boom and bust is... it's just inherent in it. There's no solution to it.
Glenn?
I thought it was very telling. You talk about the budget and how they probably could have carried on. I thought it was very telling that the statements coming out of the FIA obviously helped make this a world championship for this year. They were pretty damning, really. And they said, you know, Peugeot's got all this new technology it wants to concentrate on in its road car market. They said, well, you had the perfect platform to show the performance of all these new technologies. And they were basically saying, we can't understand why you've turned your back on this at this opportunity. So it does work both ways. You can't be seen to be spending the money in the wrong places. But how many manufacturers use motorsport to demonstrate new technologies, especially in this day and age, where you've got to use something other than petrol to get around a racetrack?
Well, that's the great thing about the relatively open rulebook that sports car offers. It does have these innovations that Formula One sort of has effectively blocked itself off from. I mean, I think to its, you know, detriment. But yeah, these hybrid cars that were coming out, you only have to look on the road, you'll see how many Priuses and other electric cars there are in a car park at our offices. Yep, you know, but that decision's been made. Whether they'll come back in time for the new cars in a couple of years' time, who knows? But I just hope that Audi keep the faith and are prepared to sort of bear the brunt of people saying, oh, they're only beating themselves. And I'm sure Toyota, when they are fully ready to really commit, will give them some pretty stiff opposition.
Good opportunity to mop up some good driving talent as well for Toyota.
Yeah, some great drivers on the market at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. After what feels like an eternity, a third manufacturer has decided to take on Ford and Holden in V8 supercars. No surprise, I guess, that in the end it was Nissan, Andrew.
Yep, I guess so. I mean, you know, if you go to a V8 race, and I was fortunate enough to go to the Surfers Paradise one the year before last, they have the display of great old cars. And obviously people have got their favourite ones from whether it was, you know, your favourite Commodore or Falcon or whatever. But there's almost as big a cheer when Jim Richards comes out on his big old Skyline. And they the Godzilla, as they were called, were just fantastic cars. And so Nissan has got a proper heritage in that Australian series. And they've got their new template for the car of the future, which is, you know, a lot more standardised bits and pieces and reducing costs or whatever, and something that they can get their back into. But I think the Kellys will run a really good team. They won't be so divisive when you go up on the hill at Bathurst. I think if you go in a Nissan top, you're going to be pretty safe. You know, I don't know what the neutral colour is. Maybe they have like Switzerland flags on them or something. But you know, and I think it's great for that series. I really do. And it looks as though that they might be a Chrysler in the waiting in the wings as well. So they got four manufacturers in there. It's you know, it's looking like a really good series. They've got some international ambitions. If that race in Houston ever happens, and they'll be there, and that's a good championship.
It goes to show also that it's not all doom and gloom out there, even in these times. You know, we've already spoken about, we've got Toyota's come back to sports cars, Volkswagen are coming back to rallying, Porsche are coming back to sports cars, we've got Nissan in V8s, we've got BMW back to DTM. So there is still, manufacturers still see the value of it. So hopefully long term, we won't be in the doldrums for too long.
The interesting thing will be whether they try and use it as a platform to try and expand it further beyond Australia, which is always dangerous ground. Obviously, they've been in the Middle East. They've had talks with places like South Africa in the past. They're going to want to try and get into Japan. I always get a little bit worried when you get a championship like this that works extremely well in a very closed environment, if you like. I mean, look back to the 90s when the DTM became the ITC and they started racing in Japan and Brazil, and the championship just imploded under the pressure of its own hubris. I think as long as they use having companies like Nissan, and if Chrysler does come in the right way, in a positive way, and make sure they play to their strengths, that could be very positive for what's a great championship.
I like the fact that Glenn's in a terribly optimistic mood today. He's talking about Toyota and BMW and Nissan. Can I just add to the list, by the way, and just say MG BTCC? Oh, so yeah, that's good news as well.
Get your plug in there.
Yeah, absolutely right.
I did have to say something positive, though, after I moaned about Kimi Räikkönen coming back and Pirelli's F1 tyres.
You've been terribly positive. It's been a true delight. Finally, Going full circle back to Formula One, Jules Bianchi has signed as Force India's third driver. No surprise there, but he's also racing in Formula Renault 3.5. Glenn, why is he doing that after two seasons of GP2?
Sharpness, really. Mm. Yeah, we've had other drivers do third driver roles, and I think Williams test driver Valtteri Bottas put it right. He said 1 year, if you've been racing all your life, you can do 1 year on the sidelines as such, not racing. But the other thing is, the main reason, I think, is that Jules' 2 years in GP2 didn't yield the results that they'd hoped, or the performances, or the consistency at all times. So I think they feel that his management, they feel that he does still need to, sort of brush up the rough edges. And he can do that. He can do World Series by Renault alongside his Force India role. And we've seen it before. Red Bull often put their drivers, their junior drivers, in there and give them some F1 experience. And as the likes of Sebastian Vettel and Daniel Ricciardo have shown, it's still what you do in the F1 car and on the F1 weekends that will determine your fate. So Jules can go there with not much pressure and just try and get back to what he was a few years ago before he got to GP2. He had Sebastian Vettel's old F3 engineer in the F3 Euro Series, and his engineer said he's quicker than Sebastian. So there's lots of potential there, and Jules hasn't quite realised it over the last couple of years. So I think by combining an F1 test role and racing in World Series, it gives him a chance to realise his potential, which hasn't happened yet. And the last point is, you can't really use GP2 just to brush up on your sharpness because it costs so much.
Certainly does, Ed.
There's a lot of pressure on Jules this year. Obviously, in the test last week at Barcelona, he had some laps on the second day, then jumped in on the third day, and in the morning, very early on cold tyres, managed to back it into the wall, which is a real shame. Bianchi's got a lot of ability. Ferrari still genuinely see him as a potential future driver, despite the fact he's had a couple of disappointing years in GP2. But there have been little mistakes here and there during GP2 races, and what happened in the Force India last week is a manifestation of the same thing. And has got his relationship with the team off on a bit of a back foot. I mean, people will forgive a rookie error. It was incredibly cold. It was so cold the speed trap had frozen in the second sector. So it wasn't easy, but there's been this pattern of little errors, and I just really hope that he's able to put that mistake behind him, because he'd be desperately wanting to carry momentum into this year. And I just hope that the team can put him in the right environment to really focus on his job and keep it together and actually deliver on the potential he's got, because he's definitely a driver with tremendous ability if he can harness it.
Psychologically, he has got to get over that fairly quickly, hasn't he? Andrew, final word on this.
The previous two third drivers at Force India, Paul de Resta and Nico Hülkenberg, both graduated to race seats. I just wonder, is he being groomed for a place there? Because as Glenn mentioned, he's very much been a Ferrari junior up until now.
It's possible. The deal is slightly different to the previous ones in that Ferrari is still involved. They wanted to see him in a Formula One car regularly. It's certainly possible. You know, both Paul de Resta and Nico Hülkenberg, if they deliver on their potential this year, they're going to have a lot of teams sniffing around them.
Might be a Merc drive going.
Well, there could be. So you can very easily see one or both of those moving on. So I expect Bianchi, that the team will be keen to promote if he does the job. He's going to get at least 9 Fridays. Obviously, that he'll be hoping that he doesn't end up getting only 9 Fridays. But I think that a lot depends on how he delivers and whether he avoids a repeat of what happened at Jerez. But you know, he's got the perfect platform. Vijay Mallya has shown that he's willing to back young drivers who deliver on the Fridays. If he does what he's able to do this year, he will be probably first in the queue to drive a Force India next year if there's a vacancy. So it's all in his hands, because then he could get a Force India race drive. Then Ferrari can look at him and say, OK, you've had a year in Force India in a race seat. You can come in and drive for Ferrari. So there's this whole future unfolding in front of him. The key is he's got to not focus on getting into Ferrari, showing what he can do. He's just got to take it, you know, day by day, session by session, just focus on his job, and he'll get there.
Glenn.
I find it slightly bizarre the way he appears to be reacting to the pressure the closer he gets to Formula One, because all the way up the ladder he's had this pressure since he was plucked from karting. He's been told by his management, you know, when he gets into his second year in a category, he's told, this year you have to win the championship or we won't take you to the next level. And he had all of this back in Formula Renault, Formula 3, and he always delivered, and he seemed so cool about it. And then for some reason it just hasn't quite clicked in GP2. I think Ferrari have come in and maybe added to that pressure. And it's just a little bit surprising, because he laid a great platform for himself mentally, I think, and he appeared to be able to deal with those things and put them to one side in the car. And it all just seems to be unravelling just at the time where you actually need to put it properly together.
Just at the wrong time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, one thing's for sure, he'll be racking up the air miles this year. Goodness me. What about you, Ed? Where are we going from here? Are you going to be racking up the air miles? Are you off to a test, a Formula One test?
I'm skipping the next one, but I'll be at the third test and then at all the races. So it's going to be fascinating, the last test in particular, because that's when you really see teams with cards on the table and you can start drawing some provisional conclusions, shall we say. Barcelona's a great track for that, so I'm looking forward to getting out and watching there and seeing exactly what progress teams have made since the Jerez test.
You see, the great thing about you, your little face lights up when you start to talk about the start of the season. You can't wait to get going, can you?
Well, we've had the few months of teams talking about aggressive cars, doing this, doing that, Kimi Raikkonen, is he any good, all this kind of thing. And you get to the first few races and you start to see the real pattern of the season, and then the stories start to emerge, the plot lines that everyone's going to be following this year. And, you know, that's what we're in the job to do and to follow and to try and communicate to the fans in the most interesting way possible. whether we achieve that is for others to decide, but we try.
Andy, air miles for you?
Yes, I'm fulfilling a lifetime ambition, heading off to the Daytona 500 to cover. It's about as far removed from F1 testing as you can get, but there'll be me and 300,000 loyal NASCAR fans getting very excited as they go around in a pack of 43 and decide 5 hours later who's won.
well, I know that you'll enjoy that, that's for sure. I reckon we might have used up all of our air miles. So, Glenn, where are you off to? Teddington.
Yeah, fortunately, and I say that honestly, I haven't got to go to an airport lounge anywhere for another couple of months, which is quite refreshing considering this time last year I'd already been to South America, Scandinavia and Spanish F1 testing. So I'll be back at base dealing with all the noise that we get from these guys.
Hearing it all coming.
How many air miles do you get for going to Knock Hill, Alan?
Yeah, it's a road trip. It's a road trip, a very comfortable road trip. It
Bring
has
back
to be
Mondello.
Said. Yes, I agree. Yes, we'd like to go to Mondello.
Do you do the road trip in one of those old Volkswagen camper vans? Because in my mind's eye, that's what you do.
No.
With okay, Alan Gow and Jason Plato.
Okay, yeah, you know. I don't want to dispel the myth, so I'll say yes, but that would be a lie. One way or t'other, the Porsche Panamera has to get up to Knock Hill, so I'm afraid it's a tough job, but somebody has to do it. So, like the boom and bust of prototype racing, the fun has come to an end. Thank you to my studio guests. Of course, on the phone, we had Grand Prix editor Mark Hughes. We also had here in the studio Andrew van der Burt. Thank you very much indeed, Ed Straw and Glenn as well. And thank you to the listener. I'm Alan Hyde, and that is a lap.